Good morning, Mr. Beckman. Good morning, Mr. Williams. Mr. Beckman, this is file number 821-0240, St. Matthew's Church of God versus State Farm Fire and Casualty. I am Judge Connolly, the presiding judge. With me also is Judge Peter Reyes and Judge James Flory, members of the panel. Mr. Beckman, it's my understanding you're having technical difficulties with your Zoom issues.
Yes, I am, Your Honor. I am very sorry for the delay, and I'm pleased to join by telephone.
Fine. Then you're comfortable proceeding with telephone. We can all hear you. Mr. Williams, can you hear Mr. Beckman?
I can.
In that case, Mr. Beckman, I suppose you can't see us, so what I'll simply do is you have 15 minutes for your argument in chief. Mr. Williams has 15 minutes, and finally you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. I will tell you when your 15 minutes starts, and I will tell you when your 15 minute ends. So with that, Mr. Beckman, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, we're gathered here after a hail and windstorm on June 11, 2017. My client commenced repairs to the property, which is a church building. Received permitting from the city of St. Paul, but the city of St. Paul required certain work to be done pursuant to code. The parties disputed whether the insurance company, State Farm, had to pay. This matter proceeded to litigation, then an appraisal where the amount of loss was determined. At that appraisal hearing, State Farm's agent testified, we paid for drywall and painting of the interior. The appraisal panel did find that the city required approximately $77,000 worth of work to be done pursuant to municipal code enforcement. So the first issue that brings us here today, or at least the legal issue, is application of Minnesota Statute 65A-10. And that is a statute from our legislature which has required replacement cost value policies such as this one to cover all the cost of repairing damaged property in accordance with minimum code as required by state or local authorities. And quoting from the statute, in the case of a partial loss, unless more extensive coverage is otherwise specified in the policy, this coverage applies only to the damaged portion of the property. The operative word for this case, or phrase, I suppose, is portion of the property. What did the legislature mean? I respectfully suggest that it certainly meant an item or an element of property, which is one thing, and this wall, the masonry part and the drywall part, permanently affixed together, that has to be damaged property under the statute. If a portion
Mr. Beckman, I'm going to interrupt you. This is Judge Connolly speaking.
Yes.
Would you explain to me, and I realize Grill versus North Star Mutual Insurance is not a published presidential opinion, but it is written by one of our most distinguished former judges, Heidi Shellhouse. Would you tell me why Grill isn't dispositive and why you don't lose based on Grill?
Yes, Your Honor. That is because the damage sought by the insured plaintiff in that case were things like rewiring the home, replumbing the home, items that were not directly impacted by wind or hail. But in this case, In this case, which is wind and hail, the subject wall was damaged by the storm. The drywall was damaged by the storm. And that is the important distinction, because the Grill case stands for the proposition that if an item of the property is not impacted by the loss, then the statute doesn't cover it. But in this case, this wall was certainly damaged by the subject loss. And so that is the main distinction with Grill. And I would add to that a separate argument that I'll get to in a minute about how the policy itself is constructed. But in the reasoning in Grill, there's a citation to John Larkin and Zulk cases in which property directly damaged by fire was not allowed to be repaired for the city. And based on the court's analysis in Grill, that was not applicable in the Grill case, because replumbing, rewiring, and the foundation, that had nothing to do with the ice dams. So there was a distinction there. But this case is in line with John Larkin and Zulk because this subject wall and everything permanently affixed to it, the drywall that is part of the wall that was damaged by the storm, we have admissions on that point, and that is why it is, Your Honor, different from Grill. I agree with the statement at the end of Grill, which states, North Star is required to pay any relevant ordinance costs necessary to repair the portion of the property damaged by the ice dam. I think that's an accurate statement of law, but as we apply it here, the portion of the property damaged by the hailstorm has got to be that entire wall. My client can't do repairs to the wall without complying with city code, and we should not, and the legislature did not, segregate out portions of the wall from other portions, I should say, portions of property from other portions of property, like an item or an element of it. The legislature said if a portion of that property is damaged, there must be full coverage, and that has to encompass a
Beckman, this is Judge Connolly again. If we disagree with you and believe the drywall is different from the wall, and I'm just saying not whether we are or not, but if we do disagree with you and see a distinction, do you lose?
I think my client has a tougher row to hoe under the statute, but I think then we need to look at the policy and how the policy is constructed, because we have two things going on here, application of the statute, but that can be different from how the policy is written and constructed. And with that, I'd like to get into the second phase of this argument, which is not so much the statute.
Mr. Beckman, this is Judge Flory. Let me ask you one question before you move on. Assuming the damage here was a hailstorm to a roof and the shingles got damaged and the, so that was the damaged property. But when the contractor removed the shingles, it was discovered that the sheeting covering the roof or the rafters in the house somehow didn't meet code. If we follow your argument, does that mean that there would be coverage not only for the damaged shingles, but also to repay the repair or replace the substandard sheeting over the roof or rafters or some other structural issue that existed?
Well, not necessarily. I certainly view the statute as requiring that kind of scope because you can't do the shingles without doing the stuff underneath it per the code. But in this case, there isn't the same distinction between the sheathing and the shingles. A wall is a shingle. A wall is a thing. It's permanently attached to each other, whereas one could, I suppose, argue
the shingles,
that
shingles aren't permanently attached to a roof. They're nailed to it, just like drywall is attached to this masonry wall. I'm having a hard time understanding your argument, how the covering of a wall and the masonry wall itself are one and the same.
My position is that the way it was written by the legislature and the way the legislature said the portion of the property, that portion of the property means everything required to do the repair, because if not, then what's really left for the insured and what's left under the statute? We need to have full repairs performed under the code or else we can't be made whole again. And that's the point of the statute, is to make the insured whole again. And therefore, I think that everything that is a component of the thing, permanently affixed as opposed to something movable under the statute, I do believe that that would be covered under the legislature and what it wrote. But then we have the second issue of the policy itself.
Mr. Beckman, before, sorry to interrupt, and before you go to the second issue, this is Judge Reyes. I do have a question along those lines as well. The first part of my question is, I believe that the undisputed facts are that the portion that had been damaged was the drywall. That was the portion that had been damaged by the June 2017 storm, correct?
Correct.
And the masonry portion was not damaged by the storm, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so when I look at the statute, you did read it, and in the case of a partial loss, and I think we're all in agreement, this is a partial loss, correct?
Correct.
So it says this coverage applies only to the damaged portion of the property. And every time you recited that last part, you just talk about the portion of the property, but that applies only to the damaged portion of the property. The only part of the property that had been damaged under undisputed facts was the drywall, not the masonry. So why is it not limited under the statute and under the provision of the insurance contract to the damaged portion of the property, which is only the drywall?
Well, in terms of the legislative intent, as I read, this coverage applies only to the damaged portion of the property. The legislature is intending insurance policies to cover all repairs triggered by lost or damaged property. So if there is a loss or there is damage, then whatever needs to be done per building codes to bring that portion of the property back into operation, that must be covered.
Okay, where in the statute does it talk about paying for all loss? Because it sounds like you're adding words to the statute. It just says in the case of partial loss, which is what we have here, this coverage applies only to the damaged portion of the property. I mean, that sounds pretty clear to me that it only covers that portion of the property that had been damaged. And here, that only portion that had been damaged was the drywall.
I understand. First, we have a triggering event, and that triggering event could trigger loss or damage. But then once we have that triggering event, then you're right, it's the damaged portion of the property. But in this case, physically speaking, you can't put the drywall back together and put it back the way it was without complying with municipal code. And I think that is what the legislature is intending by 65A10 in the damaged portion of the property.
But in order to discern the intent, we look at the plain language of the statute, and it doesn't have any language that you seem to be wanting to read into it. Where's the language in the statute where's the specific language in the statute that supports your argument?
I'm just relying on damaged portion of the property and my understanding of that term.
Okay.
And so then we have the policy language, and this is a very different thing than what the legislature intended. And of course, any ambiguity in insurance policy is written against the party that drafted it. And this is indeed a separate analysis, because insurance companies are entitled to write policies as they see fit, and they can provide more or less coverage than what the statute mandates. So when we look at this language of the property, portion of the property is not defined in the policy with a separate definition. So I respectfully suggest that the way to understand it is to look at coverage A, the buildings. All of coverage A buildings is covered, meaning additions, fixtures, and all items in a building. All of that is what is covered under coverage A. There's no qualification in this section, including this Minnesota amendment, which is an amendment to the loss payment provision of the policy, meaning how they're going to pay. And so this is very much unlike what the insurance company did for party walls. So at form 4100 at page 20, here we have State Farm saying how we're going to cover a party wall with a non-insured. So they know how to write a policy and to divide up a wall, but they didn't do that in this policy when it comes to a fully insured wall. So that is an example.
Mr. Beckman, you have less than 2 minutes left for your argument in chief. This is Judge Connolly.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. And so I urge the court to resolve any ambiguity here under the terms of the policy, which is indeed a separate analysis, in favor of this insured and in favor of coverage, because this is the loss payment section. In other words, how they pay. That's what's been amended. And that should be, any ambiguity there should be resolved in the favor of my client. And just real briefly, there's also been argument made that maybe we had wear and tear on the property and so forth. But the transcript from the appraisal hearing at page 159, they already made an argument about the fact that this was longstanding. Their expert testified at appraisal, and it's not appropriate now after appraisal and after the findings and after the form, appraisal award form, to try and rehash what other causes could be, because that would be inconsistent with the appraisal award. It would be inconsistent with Quaid. In Quaid, at the very end of Quaid, there is a statement of law that whether the appraisal award will be conclusive on all issues will depend on the nature of the damage, the probable causes, the parties' dispute, and the structure of the appraisal award. When we read Quaid, we see that facts are resolved in appraisal and then policy language is applied to it. It's not appropriate to now, after appraisal, try and have further findings of fact. Res judicata would apply to that. And then just real briefly, because I know I'm almost out of time, I ask the court if the court rules in our favor to also award statutory interest under 549.09, which is not really disputed in the briefing. We do have the date that triggers interest. That's not disputed. It's June 28, 2028. It should be 10%. And I thank the court for its time, and I look forward to the opportunity for a rebuttal argument. Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired. We'll now hear for counsel for the respondent. Mr. Williams, if you would just identify yourself for the record, please.
Yes, good morning. This is Attorney Scott Williams. I'm representing State Farm in connection with this matter. May it please the court, counsel. I think the court has narrowed in on what the issue is in this case. The court clearly understands the facts. And so I'm going to fast forward and essentially just tell you what I think are the key points in terms of State Farm's position here. Under the State Farm policy contract, it says that in order for code compliance coverage to come into play, there must be a loss or damage caused by a covered cause of loss. And that causation component tracks along with the statutory authority, as has been talked about here this morning. And so really this case boils down to causation and what the evidence is as it relates to the reasons for this Commonwealth being in the condition that it's in. And we appraised that question to the extent that there were any doubts about it whatsoever. That the appraisal panel heard that issue after hearing testimony from witnesses on both sides. The witnesses were sworn in. This was more of a formal appraisal process than some other appraisals can be. And here we had essentially a hearing, a court trial to a certain extent, if you want to call it that. I know we weren't in front of a jury, but we had an umpire who was making the calls. And ultimately, when it was concluded, the appraisal panel unanimously came back and declared that the common wall was not damaged by the storm. And so because of that, it's really just a straightforward application of the policy to the facts. And because there's no causation, there's no coverage. And in terms of whether or not the wall it can be termed to be one thing versus two, I would just submit to the panel that, you know, if you've got a factual finding that the common wall was not damaged in the storm, but the drywall was, that tells you these are distinct items for purposes of coverage. If it was the same item, you wouldn't have two separate causation elements causing the damage. And so I think that in of itself is dispositive in this case and why I think the district court's decision should be affirmed. I'll touch upon briefly the Grill decision, which I do think, even though it's not precedential, is important for the court's analysis here. And I do think that decision can be applied to the facts of this case as well, because really what you have here is a common wall problem that was discovered during the repair process. And that's similar to what happened in Grill, where there were various code problems discovered during repairs of the covered component of the loss. And in that case, the appellate court said that there was no coverage because those items were not caused by the covered cause of loss, which is the same set of circumstances here. And so to the you know, earlier arguments and questions here, I think why it's important to limit the coverage to items that are actually damaged by a storm is otherwise you are opening the door to the potential that anytime somebody suffers a covered cause of loss, if they go to conduct repairs and it turns out there's all kinds of code issues that have nothing to do with the storm event or the fire event, whatever it might be, now the insurance company said, well, you've got to bring these items back up to code. And there's just nothing in the policy or in statutory authority that supports that. And I would argue it's not good public policy either, because when you have situations like we have here with this common wall, it apparently had had a lot of issues for a long time based on the evidence that came out during appraisal and that State Farm's engineer discovered during his investigation. And so because of that, it was a longstanding code issue well before there was ever any storm event. And so to the extent that that cost then gets shifted on to an insurance company because there's a storm event, I think it disincentivizes homeowners, businesses from ensuring that their property is code compliant to the extent that they can. And so for all of those reasons, I really see this as a straightforward policy application to the facts. And because the facts are set in stone, they are not able to be disputed at this point. It's ripe for summary judgment. And I think the district court got it right and should be affirmed. And I'll be happy to take any questions that the panel would have at this point.
Thank you. I don't think there are any. Mr. Beckman, you will have, just give us a second, we'll readjust your time. You will have 5 minutes for your rebuttal beginning now.
Thank you, Judge. I disagree that the appraisal award form is some sort of admission that there are two components to the wall. Appraisal award form was structured consistent with Quaid to give the court useful findings of fact, and then this dispute about the extent of the policy and how the policy reads can then be applied to these factual findings. Nobody conceded that there were two parts to the wall, and it's not instructive. Appraisal award form, like Quaid, is very useful because now we can have a legal determination of how the policy applies to it. With respect to the concern expressed by counsel that our position opens the door, we are seeking something far more narrow and far more discreet than what the plaintiffs in Grill sought. What we're seeking is essentially a finding or a holding that one thing, one fixture, one item, which is what this is because it's permanently affixed. There's just one thing called wall. People don't look at a wall and say, there's the drywall part, there's the masonry part. When a repair contractor, a person, an insured, they look at the wall and they see a wall. And if the city of St. Paul is not allowing the drywall to be reinstalled without addressing the rest of the wall, my position is that is not only covered by statute, but also important, separate analysis, how this policy is structured. Because this loss payment provision in the Minnesota amendment looks so much different than how State Farm wrote the portion of the party wall. There, they took the time to segregate out what is covered and what is not. Here, that didn't happen. So this loss payment provision, if there's any ambiguity in it, and I certainly think there is, because State Farm never took the time to define portions of the property. Best way to resolve it is to look at coverage A and what coverage A the property says. And the property says all fixtures, certainly drywall attached to masonry wall is a fixture under this policy. It is affixed to masonry. And with that, I thank the court for its time. And again, I apologize for the technical issues I had. Thank you.
Mr. Beckman, this is Judge Reyes. I do have one quick question. Do you think that the statute, Minnesota statute 65A.10 subdivision 1, is it your position that that statute is ambiguous or unambiguous?
I'm sorry, what was the statutory reference again? Was it 65A10 or 01?
65A.10 subdivision 1.
Well, I don't think the statute is particular. I wouldn't say that's ambiguous. Unfortunately, it would have been nice if the legislature would have expanded on damaged portions of the property. But I think it's very reasonable to look at portions of the property to be one fixture, one item, one thing. I suppose one could say that's not the model of clarity and what they meant, but if a thing that is held together by nails and screws is damaged, I think the legislature meant that whole thing must be repaired.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Beckman. Thank you for Mr. Williams. The matter is submitted. We will issue our opinion within 90 days. And I'm glad we were able to get Mr. Beckman on the line. So with that, this matter is concluded. We'll move on to the next oral argument.